After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Welcome to the Real Love podcast series, right here on the Sharon Salzberg Metta Hour. This series features a variety of conversations with the world's finest thinkers and teachers, exploring Sharon's latest book, Real Love, The Art of Mindful Connection.
Hi, I'm Sharon Salzberg, and I'm here today with my friend Catherine Burns. Catherine is a longtime artistic director of The Moth. She's been the lead director on The Moth's main stage for more than a decade. She's helped hundreds of people craft their stories, including a Nobel laureate, a retired New York City cop, a jaguar tracker, and an exonerated prisoner. She's a producer of the Peabody Award-winning The Moth Radio Hour and the editor of the international bestseller The Moth, 50 True Stories, and the bestseller All These Wonders. Catherine and I are both so busy that we usually just meet for breakfast. This is really exciting. I'm seeing you in a whole other kind of light. You know, it's like the light of the day toward the end of the day,
totally.
Toward sunset. It's like, wow.
You exist beyond 9 a.m. at the LBU.
I know. It's like on 11th Street and Broadway.
Right. Hi.
And anybody who really knows me knows that I'm like a total night owl, and that's like a big deal.
Thank you.
It's the only time I see Catherine. So I'm very excited to have a chance to have the conversation with you. And I thought maybe we could start by you talking about what The Moth is and how did you come to be a part of the organization?
Totally. So The Moth is all about true stories told live. It started out as a live show in New York City. We would do these shows. I could give you the history of The Moth if you want. Like, do you want to, should I talk about how it started?
Yeah.
So The Moth was founded by a gentleman named George Doss Green. He was a writer, and he had grown up in Savannah, Georgia, and he and his friends would sit around on a porch on this little island off the coast of Georgia, and they would tell stories sort of deep into the night and play poker, and there was a hole in the screen, and the moths would flutter about, and so they started calling themselves The Moths. They were like, the moths will meet tonight. So he moves to New York City, he becomes a writer, and he missed those evenings of just friends sitting around telling these long, complicated, you know, deeply personal stories to each other. And he decided to try to bring the spirit of that to New York City. So he had an evening at his apartment. He invited a bunch of friends, and five people were selected to hold the floor. No one could interrupt them. They each had, you know, their 10, 15 minutes to tell a story. And that's how it began. And so that was 20 years ago, last June. So what we do now is we produce these live shows at this point all around the world. We're in like 28 cities where people come and tell stories in front of a live audience. Some of the shows we curate, like we invite people to come tell their stories. You know, we've been trying to get you for quite a long time. One of these days it's going to happen.
It'll work.
But some of the shows are open mic night competitions, which are really fun. And then we record all of these shows, and the best stories go out on our radio show and podcast. Or sometimes appear in like the books and mm-hmm. various other outlets.
And I know you do one program in a cemetery. How did that happen?
So Greenwood Cemetery, which is just, if you've never been there, it's such a gorgeous, gorgeous park. And I think their tagline is it's a place that the dead create for the living. It's this beautiful old cemetery, and they do live events there. Live events. That sounds sort of funny thinking about the cemetery. But anyway, but it's amazing. Yeah, so you arrive and they take you up via trolley and your torchlight. And we did a storytelling show in the middle of the graveyard with people with picnic blankets, like sitting on the graves. And we did a stage and did all stories ahead, you know, sort of a little bit of a head nod to death. But it was one of my favorite Moth Nights of all time. And, you know, we're doing it again this summer. And he just knew the date because maybe that'll be the one. But it's pretty magical being there. You know, and there's something crazy about being in a cemetery in the middle of the night and doing something that is a joyful celebration.
Mm-hmm. Are there unusual venues, or is that kind of the edge?
I think that's one of the more extreme ones that we've done. Although we've been talking, do you know Atlas Obscura?
No.
They're this amazing group in New York City, and they do kind of crazy events all over the city in interesting places. And we've talked about trying to get in touch with them to see if we could, you know, like do the Moth in an abandoned subway station, or like, just wouldn't that be cool?
It'd be really cool.
Yeah, it'd be an adventure. So maybe they'll hear this and we'll get in touch with him.
Well, in a way, it's in a funny way, it's almost like a reflection of real life, because we're always telling ourselves stories anyway.
Yeah.
You know, so if you're riding the subway, or you're in a cemetery, or you're, you know, visiting a friend, or, you know, there's something going on.
Like, totally. Yeah, I mean, that was the idea. Storytelling is obviously the world's one of the most ancient art forms. We certainly didn't invent it. But I think what was a little bit different about the Moth when George and his friends launched it is this idea of taking like a dinner party story. The stories aren't meant to feel like a big performance. It's just meant to seem like a story that you're telling over the kitchen table, except there's 300 people there at dinner instead of two. And so, you know, but taking these stories that are very intimate and putting them on stage in front of a live audience and then recognizing that as an art form. I think that's what was maybe new about the Moth. And now, of course, one of the things that thrills us is there's thousands and thousands of Moth-like organizations that have popped up all around the world. And so it really has become what we think of as a modern storytelling movement that we're just one little piece of.
That's fabulous. I mean, I know a little bit about political organizing, which often does start with telling your story.
Yeah. We've worked with a lot of activists instead of tell their stories, or like people who are the heads of NGOs. We do a lot of work with the Gates Foundation. We're actually doing our first show in Nairobi on Thursday night. I'm obviously not going to be there.
Are you going?
Yes. No, I'm not going. But yeah, because often, you know, people who are, they create an NGO because there's a problem they see in the world that's personal that they want to help solve. So we'll sometimes come in and try to help them work their personal story into the message of what they're trying to do. Because people tend to, sometimes like these big problems in the world can be very abstract. But if you boil it down into a story, it can be easier for people to absorb.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you know, I'm like so eager to be trained by you.
That's so funny. I don't know how much I can do. You're such a natural raconteur.
Thank you.
I will do my best to teach you something.
You will definitely teach me a lot.
I'll try to like sort of like earn, like in our friendship, I'll try to give something back to you because you've given me so much.
Well, thank you. But, you know, you definitely could train me. And I'm so curious, like, what do you listen for? I mean, and writing, you know, because of, yeah, obviously I write, you know, and so. What I've learned to listen for is sort of what's extra, you know, like especially because I feel like I write about things that are noble and amazing, you know, and love and faith and things like that. And so my bad tendency is to get really elevated, you know, and to lose the sort of direct simplicity of communication, you know, of connection. And
totally.
And so I see these sentences sometimes and I think, oh my God, you know, it's like, that's pretty highfalutin. Like, let's bring it down, you know.
Totally, because the big ideas are sometimes absorbed better when you know, like in your book, Faith, where there's just gigantic ideas about Buddhism, about the world, and about meditation, but in each one is grounded in your personal journey. Mm-hmm. So it's one of my favorite of your books.
Thank you. So is that what the kind of thing you listen for is? Something that sounds inauthentic or too much, or
We definitely don't want we definitely want things that do sound authentic. And like we worked with activists, we don't want them to just kind of do their spiel, and they have to tell it through story. Like if they try to do something where you can hear the message, if something gets preachy, the quickest way to shut down a Moth audience is by trying to preach or to try to talk at them, like to give a performance. This is the one thing you can do. This is one of the few ways you can bomb at the Moth, is to be like just super over rehearsed. Because what people want, people would rather you mess up, but people are always afraid that they're going to forget their story because we don't allow people to have notes. You know, we're terribly mean that way. But we always tell people, if you forget something and say, oh my God, I totally forgot to tell you the part, and then go back and pick it up, they're only going to love you more, because all our audience wants is for you to be human. Is they're coming out seeking that human connection. But yeah, one of the things we look for in moth stories, especially because, like, the difference between, like, people, like, we often get compared to TED, which is more of a talk, more of a verbal essay. So we always look for moments of change. Mm-hmm. So we look for stories where something happened, and as a result of this interesting thing happening to you, you go from you have one point of view in the beginning, and there's some shift in you as a result of the events that happen. And it can be subtle. I mean, we don't want things to be too wrapped up in a bow or, like, you know, after school special. but we always look for some just shift in perspective. We think that makes things much more interesting, because usually also if it was something that caused you to change, it was probably a big moment in your life. Mm-hmm. We sometimes say, this sounds a little bit harsh, but we say, who are you at the beginning and who are you at the end and why do we care? But of course, what we really mean is, why do you care? Because if you can convince me why you care so much, then I'm going to care too.
Mm-hmm. Do you think really in the end we're all, like, kind of one person?
I do. I after years and thousands of stories I've heard and worked on, I 100% believe that we have what we have in common is so much more abundant than what that separates us. I truly believe that, even looking around the crazy state of the world we're in right now. I also think that people want to connect. People want to find that commonality. You know, even people who might have really different views on bigger things, you can sit down and show each other pictures of your kids, or, you know, talk about, you know, something that happened in your childhood. You know, there's always a way to connect. I think human beings naturally want to connect with each other.
That's great.
Yeah. Maybe that sounds a little Pollyanna, but I truly believe it.
It's beautiful. Have you always believed it? Or has the work kind of influenced you?
I always believed it, but I think I wondered if I was just delusional. And now, after I've been at the Moth, it's going to be 16 years in a few weeks. And before that, I was a fan, you know, coming to every show. And, you know, I was sort of obsessed with it before I came to join the staff of two at the time. I feel like the Moth proved to me that what I wanted to believe about the world was true.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what's kept me in it for so long. You know, I never get bored. I'm always like, the second I don't feel like hearing the story, let someone else get my job, because I don't deserve to do it anymore.
That's so interesting. So you were you just heard about it and you started attending, and then?
Yeah, I was working in film and television. I'd always wanted to be a filmmaker since I was a really little girl. Mm-hmm. And then I actually got in the film industry and discovered it just wasn't what I wanted. It turns out that I don't really like being on sets that much, nor do I like being in editing suites, and that's what being a filmmaker is. And so I think if you had, you know, asked me when I was a little girl if I'd understood what I really wanted, I would have said, I want a meaningful job that has something to do with something artistic, where I can work in a meaningful way with people I love and have that work connect outward and help people in the world. Now, of course, I couldn't say that at 6 or 7. Right. But to me at the time, it was like, oh, make a movie. That's the thing that will do that. And so, yeah, so it was like I was in my late 20s and had just moved to New York City and was trying to figure out what I wanted to do next. I sort of refer to this now as my is this all there is phase. And someone told me about the Moth. And I went the first night, and it was like this weird moth on a boat that was parked in the harbor. And I was just so blown away, because it was the opposite of everything I'd been doing in film, where it's like, you know, like 30 people to tell a story, even on a little indie film. And so the fact that you have a single person telling their own story, simple lighting, just one microphone, no notes with the audience. And I fell madly in love with it. And I just started coming to every single show and trying to help them out in any way I could, because they were so small that it was just two employees. And they were really popular. You know, they were hard to get in. But it wasn't like there wasn't a radio show or a podcast or anything like that then. And then eventually I'd actually just taken this job that I didn't really want. I was supposed to start that job on September 12th, 2001. So the job went away for a while. And in the meantime, over the course of the next 2 or 3 months, I know this is a level of detail, but I actually went and helped out at the Red Cross, and they offered me a job. And I was like, well, gosh, maybe I'm going to just totally do this other thing. But then right around that time, the Moth's first artistic director quit.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an opening.
So then there was a staff of one.
Right. And I forwarded her quitting email to the remaining employee and said, whose job is open and how do I apply?
Just as a side note, it's hard to believe that was more than 16 years ago.
Isn't that insane?
Yeah. It's really kind of amazing.
I think I thought I was just coming on for a few months to help them out, or like for a little short period. They had just signed this TV deal, The Moth, and I was like, oh no, TV's going to mess up with my favorite happy thing. And then I was like, I speak TV. Maybe I'll go help them for a while. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, a few months turned into a decade and a half, which is so crazy.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But I'm still having so much fun.
I'm also, you know, in teaching meditation, I'm also very interested in kind of the damaging stories, you know, the ones that we carry around just habitually. And in my last book, Real Love, I ended up having two sections about stories. And I had an editor that, looking toward that, thought it was way too much, you know, and that. But when I actually produced it, it was actually okay because there's so much. You know, one section was on stories we tell ourselves about ourselves.
Mm.
So that might be wonderful, you know, maybe onward leading and maybe encouraging more often. It seems like it's, you know, pretty critical, kind of harsh, maybe unjust toward ourselves, expecting too much. And then there's a whole section on stories others tell about us.
Mm. And what we believe and absorb.
Mm-hmm.
Or don't absorb and don't believe.
Right. You know, and the ones that we do absorb sometimes are not that healthy either.
Exactly. You know, it's so true. I mean, we both know, right, that the past is a thing that changes constantly depending on the stories we tell about it and the stories we tell ourselves about it. I've seen this so many times where somebody will go in to tell a story and in examining the events of the past with another person, they suddenly see the past in a really different light. Like one of the things we do, we have a community program, and so we'll do things in, you know, homeless shelters, and we'll work with, you know, various vulnerable populations. And you'll sometimes see people when they start to put the story of their life together, and like, you know, the beginning, middle, and end, that they'll see that they had more agency than they realized. And that can be very empowering. You know, so not to say like you're to blame for the things that happened to you, but more that just like that you have more agency than you realize at most points. And that can be a really empowering feeling. And they suddenly will look back and see the events of their past in a really different way. And that's always really thrilling to see. There's also, you know, there's also timelines on stories. Like, so we recommend that a certain amount of time have passed since the story took place before you tell it, because we find that people need time to process it. We're not like the nightly news where we can go out and something that happened last week, we're going to go get that person and bring them up. Usually we joke that it's like 5 years from a divorce and 10 years from a death. Although a psychiatrist recently told me it should be the reverse.
Oh,
that divorce is much more traumatizing.
5 years from
a divorce and 10 years from a death.
Or the opposite.
But someone really recently said it should really be the opposite. But, you know, and so there's, you know, you always have like the Tig Notaros. I don't know if she's somebody in the world of these of listeners here that know, but she's a comedian who infamously walked out on stage in L.A., having been diagnosed that morning with breast cancer, and did one of the most amazing comedy sets of all time about it. But most people are not Tig. Most people really need time to process it. We all have all of our Moth directors. We have like the ones that got away. And one of my people was a woman who had been on the Kinder transport. She had been smuggled out of Germany as a child. And I went to meet with her. I tracked her down in the suburbs of London because she had this gorgeous story about a little boy on the train who she met and helped. And when she started telling me that story, she would speak about herself, like in the third person. You know, Esther said this. Esther sat down and, you know, it's like, wow, you know, 70 years. And Esther wasn't ready to tell that story. You know, so for some people, they might be ready in 5 minutes. But a little bit of time going by, I think, definitely helps people process things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was some advice I got, actually, when I was working on the book Faith, which is really like my faith story, and it involves, you know, the story of my childhood and, you know, lots of loss and trauma and things like that. And I was stuck many times working on that book. And at one point I was talking to somebody who teaches writing and, you know, we're kind of looking at what I was doing. And she said, yeah, you know, she said, you're ready. You know, she said, if it was too soon, it would be terrible writing, you know, because it would just be, it wouldn't be a bad thing to do for you necessarily.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of healing or, you know, just telling the story as one might. But, you know, she said, in terms of the quality of the writing, it's going to be you processing rather than you presenting, you know, and sort of, you know, Otherwise, you'd be kind of secretly asking for help.
Yeah, exactly. You know? The biggest, one of the hardest things that any of us deal with as directors of the Moth is, and by directors, I mean we just like coach people and help them with tell their stories, just for listeners who might not know, is assessing whether or not somebody's ready to tell their story. And it can be very tricky. Like, you know, someone can come to us and you can tell they're not ready, you know, because it's not always so extreme as, you know, the Esther story. It's like there's a churn when people are still processing it. Where one of the things I always say is, if you can't figure out your ending, you're probably not ready to tell it. Like, that tends to indicate that, like, you haven't found a place to land it yet. But sometimes we, like, really get on the train with somebody and, you know, they might not be quite ready to tell it. We check in with them again in 6 months, in a year, and it might be 5 years later they finally tell it. And so one of the nice things about us not just being a staff of two is that we can have these long time relationships mm-hmm. with people and mm-hmm. kind of go on the journey with them. And when they're finally ready to do it, there's a space for them.
Yeah, that's great. And I never think, you know, when I got that advice, it was correct. I was ready, you know. I
didn't, oh, definitely. From having read the book.
But I was ready, you know.
Yeah.
And it was also, it couldn't have happened sooner. I mean, it just would have been a different thing. It, you know, it might well have been part of my own healing journey, but it wouldn't have been really an offering.
Totally. Absolutely. Yeah.
Let's see. So still on this topic of stories others tell about us.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, how do we get that filter into, and it's really a question of space, right? Or some spaciousness to realize that, well, that's that person's conditioning, or that's that person's impression, or, you know, I grew up in New York City in Washington Heights in an Eastern European Jewish neighborhood. And every once in a while I meet somebody, you know, from Texas who says, I never met a Jew till I was in college. Mm. I say, really? You know, yeah. Like, what do you think they were like? You know, and it was always weird. You know, and we live surrounded by these kinds of projections.
Yes.
All the time. And so there's something about having a sense of almost like knowing who you are apart from the story.
Yes.
That seems very important. And that, of course, I feel, for me, it came to me through meditation.
Mm. That makes sense. I definitely think, I mean, because there's also positive stories people tell about us that we don't believe, right? Because we're so busy beating ourselves up.
Yeah, that's true.
That's what I was thinking about before when you first said it. So there's both, like, people telling negative stories about us that we absorb, and then us not being willing to see the beautiful story that others see in us. And yeah, I think that these things are very tricky. And like, how do you, you know, take yourself away from the, you know, not get too caught up in the story. One of the exercises we have people do, it might be an interesting one for you to do when you eventually do the Moth, because I feel like some of the stories you've just told so many times, is that we have somebody write down 20 things that took place around the time of the story that aren't in the story. And it's not because we want them to add them back into the final story. It's because it viscerally takes you back into the space again. And then suddenly you tell the exact same story again, and it's fresh and you're present in the story. But there's something about it too, because there's something about trying to examine the things around it that just give you a different perspective.
So interesting.
Yeah. It's like we find that it works. Especially if somebody's been down the road with us, we occasionally get people where, you know, they'll go out and they'll tell the same story 15 times.
Yes.
And, you know, there's been a lot of scientific studies that the way we tell the story, like, affects our memory of the story, and that the memory, like, that you remember telling the story as opposed to the memory. Does that make sense?
No, totally. Yeah, totally.
It's so this, like, little, and so the more you tell it that way, the more that becomes what happened.
Yeah.
And you get, like, over time you can get very divorced from the actual event. Yeah, but I do, I mean, just in my own life, you know, I always am trying to write my own stories and things. I think about these things all the time, because you're forcing yourself to put it down on the page and trying to look at what was that shift and what really happened there. There's just often so many new things to be discovered if you're willing to reflect and you're willing to do that soul searching and digging. Even if it's not something, if you're not somebody like who's going to go write a book,
mm-hmm.
like you are, you know, if it's just somebody who's like trying to process their own, the events of their past, so they can feel like a better person or sleep better at night or be a better parent.
Did you ever have anybody, or did you ever have any two or three people tell the same story, each from their own angle?
No, people always want us to do this, and we've never actually taken it on. I'm not sure. I think we want to take it on. Like, every year we say we should, We've talked about doing one, like sort of, we call this like the Rashomon night, you know, where you would have like maybe a parent and a child.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, I think it would be really cool. But I think that we're always just like, oh my God, that would be so much work. And somebody just needs to decide to do it and go out and then find the right people to do it. Because it could be that they tell the same story. It also could be that they just tell a story that involves the same people. And so you kind of get to know a whole new set of you get to hear a different story about these same people in the second act. Mm-hmm. But I think that can be interesting because we all tell these stories so differently, right? And it's interesting. I've been trying to work on a memoir, and one of the things I've been trying to do is go to my closest friends and say, "Tell me the story of the time we did X," and I record it because I want to hear them tell it because I've just to hear a totally fresh person. Mm-hmm. And so sort of fact checking myself. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And also listening to them talk about it gets me to remember it in a new way. So.
Outrageous. Did you find things changed for you when you began meditating? I don't know when you actually began.
So I began because of you.
Oh, thank you.
can I tell the story about how I came to your first class?
Sure, tell the story.
It's so funny. I never thought that night I would be sitting here telling you the story here on this podcast, which is, of course, my favorite podcast. So, I'd been trying to meditate for years with no success. I actually bought at one point, I don't even know if I've told you this, I bought your little book that had like a CD insert. And then it sat next to the chair in my bedroom for like literally 7 years. And so I just tried and tried, and I would just sit and all the excuses and the things that people say, and they can't figure it out. And finally, I was on the phone with my friend Robin Thorpe. Well, shout out to Robin. And I was just like, I've decided I'm giving it up. I can't. It's too stressful. I can't. And she's like, listen, I think you live in New York City. Sharon Salzberg does events all the time. If you go to one class with her and it doesn't work, I will leave you alone.
That's great. Yay, Robin.
Yay, Robin. And I was like, okay, fine. Because she goes, I just think you're going to connect with her. I think you're going to be your sort of person. Just go to one class. So I went, and you were doing a thing at the Tibet House, mm-hmm, which mm-hmm. I was coming up again. And I went and I sat all the way in the back. I arrived very early and sat all the way in the back. And I sat in the seat chosen so that if I was bored and uncomfortable, I could leave without really being seen by you. There's the pillars in there. You can kind of hide behind. So I picked the seat, and then slowly it was like, then of course, 5 minutes later, it was like 1,000 people and like totally packed. And you came in. And I remember you walked in and you were wearing this, like, you were all bundled up in this winter coat. And you just looked like you just looked comfortable. You know, like I think I'd gone to these things where it was like these little yogi people, lovely people, I'm sure. I don't mean to knock other people. But I was just like, and I was like, you just came in and you just felt like authentic and wise, but accessible. Mm-hmm. So I immediately was like, I perked up the second I saw you come in and you put down your coat and you sat down. And so we started, and like 5 minutes later, the hour and a half class was over.
Yeah.
And I remember what I was most struck by was that when you did the group meditations, I was disappointed because they seemed too short. Whereas before, I could not even sit through 2 minutes. I don't even know how long those were, but at least 10, right? You do them.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, oh, you're ready. And so something really shifted for me in that. I think we could talk about it in detail or not, but when I had like a mental image of like almost like the reverse of the trash compactor in the Star Wars movies, like there was something going in the reverse and pushing all the garbage out of my head backwards. And I felt so good and so clean when I walked out that night. And I came to all the rest of the classes. I think Robin was there on the last night and forced me to come talk to you. And she's like, you go talk to her. And I was like, I'm too starstruck. And she's like, don't be an idiot. But ever since then, I've meditated every night. So
that's fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I think we were talking at breakfast earlier this week, how sometimes it's just 10 minutes. But often when I get going, then you can pick another one and it could be a half hour. I'm going to try to add the morning. I think I need to do an energizing morning one. But it's really made a difference. And, when I slack off, I feel like I can tell, my husband can tell, my son of a 7-year-old can tell, my staff. Suddenly every little thing just feels so hard to manage. And that's the one thing that if I go and just add to the time, all of a sudden everything feels really manageable. And running the Moth, it's a little, we're talking about caretaking. I know you do your course for caretakers, and there can be something to it. It's like caretaking, because the Moth isn't just a show. It really is a community. And so, that self-care, if you're going to actually, have the great honor of helping manage and run that community, it's so important. And so it's been a real game changer for me.
That's fabulous.
That was long.
That was great. I'm but so happy. I'm happy sitting here listening to you. It's like afternoon. It's my shining hour.
Oh, right. You know? This is when I'm really like totally slumping off. But I'll do it for Sharon. I'll do it for Sharon.
if you add 10 minutes in the morning, I was thinking, could we meet at 9:15 instead?
We definitely
of 9?
Can. We can. We can. Should we just decide now that we'll meet at 9:15 from now on?
Oh, good.
Okay. We can even do 9:30.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to make you late for work.
It's okay. We'll work it out.
I'm the one who doesn't have regular hours. You know,
But it was a game. It really was a game changer for me, and you like opened the door. That then once I walked through it, then I was able to find other people and other things, and I started reading all of your books, and it something clicked in my brain that night that never has unclicked. So thank you again, a thousand times. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. I mean, obviously, it changed my whole life too, and it's been the core of my life ever since. It's never kind of changed that, you know, like I don't ever look back and think, well, too bad I didn't go to graduate school or, you know.
Totally.
I like to learn a lot of things that I probably would have learned in graduate school, but there may still be time.
Totally. I regret, of course, not discovering it much younger. Mm-hmm. I mean, because that was only like a couple of years ago. But but that being said, I guess it comes to you when it's going to come to you.
Totally. And I guess maybe the last thing I'll bring up is just the creative process. And, you know, for me, it is centered in a lot of ways in meditation, just the kind of space that the meditative techniques create, you know. And I think of myself as a writer, and I think about the strengths and weaknesses that I have. And I realize that it's like this is actually a big reflection on faith, on that book. Like, I would say that the best writing I did on faith was two times. One was on... I just woke up in the morning and the sensor had not yet woken up. And the other was when I was meditating. And I wasn't meditating thinking, how am I going to connect chapter 1 to 2?
Right.
I would just sit.
Yep.
And somehow within that, the intuition would arise.
Totally. It was like, it's how people always talk about things coming to them in the shower.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's just something. I think it's so critical that dormancy is critical to the artistic process.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's something, Gretchen Rubin, who's a writer, who writes a lot about happiness. She has this thing about keeping an empty shelf in your house because it's like, it just like allows there to be space for things to come in, which I think is so interesting.
That would be hard actually.
There's zero empty shelves in my house right now. I'm about to move. So maybe that could be a goal. But I think there, one of the things I've had to learn to do, which might sound insane, but is to schedule unscheduled time. Because if I don't do it, I will schedule every second of my day, and that there's an hour that the only deal is like I can actually do something productive at that hour, but I can't decide in advance what's happening and that I really am free to do anything. Because I find when I'm doing things like that, just like, you know, joyful things come to me. I have ideas. I think of solutions to problems we're having. I also think of new ideas and things that we can do. And those ideas don't come when things are just so packed and so cluttered.
That's fantastic. Okay, so 15 minutes of practice in the morning.
Okay.
Is that
my assignment?
Yes. It is my assignment.
Okay, good.
It's a little too selfish. I feel bad.
No. I love it.
I can sleep later and still meet you for breakfast. And then that might go against the code of ethics or something. And then unscheduled time. What a great idea.
Yeah, I had this amazing vacation like 3 years ago where I took a week off and didn't plan anything. Like usually when I take a week off, even for a staycation, I'm like, I'm going to clear out the file. There's like an agenda, but I didn't. And it was like such an amazing week and I got so much stuff done, but nothing that I'd planned to get done. And I discovered, you know, I ended up going through all these old files and discovering all these fun letters and things from friends. And it was just, there's just a lot of information that I touched that week that was in my house that I would have never touched anyway, that I needed right then, that would have never come to me if I hadn't created that space. And I felt very inspired by that. Mm-hmm. I don't always keep it up, but I try to. And the more I do, I think the better off I am, certainly. And I think the better off the moth is. I mean, ultimately, we try with our creative team to have time, to have down times. I mean, you know this because we've been trying to schedule you to tell a story for so long. I'm like, well, there's not really anything between like July and October. And then we also try to the end of December and through January, because I just find that my team needs to, there's to be just some times of the year when they're not trying to cast a show and find story. Like, they need that time to just be themselves, so they can come back and then feel excited to do it again.
Yeah, no, that's great. And then the last question or comment. Since my last book, I shouldn't say my last book, my most recent book.
Yes.
Because we're hoping it's not my last book.
Please don't let it be. Yeah.
My most recent book was about love, real love. I like to ask people on this podcast, what comes to your mind when you hear the word love? Like, what do you think about the concept, the thing?
Well, you know, I spend a lot of my time thinking about the word empathy. I feel like it's a little overused right now. I mean, you and I've joked before about which phrase is more overused right now, mindfulness or storytelling.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think you argue that it should be mindfulness, and I agree with that. Like, yeah. I let you win that.
Yeah.
But yeah, so empathy is a word that I just am hearing a lot right now. But it's something that we come back to again and again, because when I think about, you know, what is love, but, you know, trying to see the, you know, it's seeing the best in someone, it's looking at someone with, you know, compassion is, I know, a word I've got, I've learned from you a lot. And like, look, trying to see the world from their point of view, because when you can do that, you can connect it, like, in with the why that somebody just did something, you know, why would someone think that, do that, say that? And I think that empathy is what, you know, leads us to love. And of course, you know, especially love is the way you define it in your book, not just, you know, romantic love, or even the way, like, I love my son, but like a general, you know, loving kindness towards the universe, that if you can find that empathy is a way to connect you into that. So that's probably the number one thing that I would think, you know, and, you know, and also authenticity. I mean, we go around, right, with such these little, you know, fake shells so often, you know, shells, maybe the word shellac, I think, shellacked with the, you know, through the world, especially with Facebook and social media and how we present ourselves to the world. And I don't think it's any coincidence in the age of, like, the internet and texting and all these, like, sort of distant ways to connect, that this storytelling movement has come up, that even as we're all on our devices, that people are like, wait, but I also want to go outside, and I want to go down to this, you know, bar restaurant near my house, and I'm going to sit in the dark room, and I'm going to listen to my neighbors tell stories.
Wow. Wow. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was so much fun to be here with you in the afternoon.
I know. Here we are.
Yeah.
It's
thank you so much for having me. You know, I'm a huge fan.
Well, I'm a huge fan too. So. And we'll make it work. We'll find a date someday.
Hooray. You're coming, we'll coming soon. Yes.
I had one thought of, oh God, I hope they don't start like the morning hour or the breakfast stories or something.
No.
That would be the one date I can do. And
no.
I go, oh, it's morning.
No, we almost never do shows during the day. We find it doesn't really work that well.
Oh, interesting.
Every now and then. We did one, like, just so boring afternoon show once at, like, I think the Brooklyn Botanical Garden. And we were like, hashtag never again. Like, it just wasn't. I don't know. There's something mothy. Like, you want to sit in the dark in the light and connect. Like, it's one of those.
Theater.
It's a nighttime thing.
Yeah. Fabulous. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And if you'd like to check out some of Catherine's work, you can visit www.themoth.org and listen to their podcast and much more.
Yay.
Thank you for listening. For more information about Sharon's many offerings and her ongoing teaching schedule, please visit her website at SharonSalzberg.com.